Live from the I-10 corridor, it's the Dave Nemo Show.
And as promised, it's time to talk with one of our great friends, Bridget Blitch, attorney at law, with Blitch Wesley Attorneys at Law. And I'll give you the contact info in just a little while. And this is protecting your livelihood. And today, Bridget is going to kind of walk us through, maybe the minefield of going into court. First off, I think the first thing to do is learn how to avoid judgments. Sometimes you have to pursue them, and sometimes you get caught in the wheels or in the gears of justice, so to speak. So we'll find out why it matters, what you want to do, and what you certainly don't want to do. And I think one of the first things you want to do is to open your mail. But we'll talk about that here in just a little bit. Also, we'll get into the litigation section and what is all entailed with that and liability. Sometimes there is joint liability if someone is driving for a company. Yep, they're going to sue the company, but guess what? They're also going to sue the driver. And if you own the company as an owner-operator, whoa, that's a double whammy. And we'll also talk about some of the do's and don'ts in terms of how to respond to a complaint, if there is one, and what you should do about that. It's called Protecting Your Livelihood for a Good Reason, and Bridget Blitch is going to give us some of those reasons when we come right back. Rand McNally's truck-specific GPS. The TND 740 has been redesigned in and out to streamline the daily drive and your business. It includes a lightning-fast quad-core processor that calculates routes in seconds, a brighter screen, and simplified icons for easier at-a-glance recognition, and an easy-on, easy-off magnetic mount. It even has audio-out functionality, so you can route the sound from your device to speakers in your cab. And that's not all. The TND 740 also features over-the-air updates, so you can be sure that you always have the latest maps. To learn more, visit randmcnally.com. /TND740.
Want a chance to win a limited edition Jack Daniels Indian Chieftain motorcycle? How about a race-ready Bandit Big Rig Series truck? For a chance to win, all you have to do is buy Minimizer. These are products that are tested and tortured to help save you time and money. Fenders, floor mats, seats, mattresses, products you need for your semi-truck because they respect the driver. This is your chance to win a $40,000 motorcycle or a $40,000 Bandit race truck. For full contest details, go to Minimizer.com.
He left home when he was 17. The rest of the world here on the scene. And everybody knows Boss. A rolling stone gathers no moss. Now you probably call him a tramp, but his soul's a little deeper than that. He's a highway child.
Well, good morning again, everybody. The Dave Nemo Show rolling on into August. And Bridget, happy August 1st. Bridget Blitch, good morning.
Good morning, Dave. Well, happy August. How are you doing this morning?
Doing great. Getting ready for GATS, getting ready for the dog days. It's all coming down the pike.
It sure is. It's going to be a great month. I know it.
Great. It's going to be hot and great. And you can't beat that.
Yes. Exactly. Well, hopefully I'll be able to catch up with you, I guess, later this month and all of our good listeners.
We are definitely looking forward to that for sure. Today we kind of get right down into the weeds, so to speak, I think, in terms of judgments, how to avoid them, and whether you should or should not pursue them. And I guess the overriding question, maybe to kind of get the ball rolling, would be, why does it matter if somebody has a judgment against you?
And so this is the part of my job that I like, because I have the opportunity to share with people information that they can take and use to avoid a bad situation or do something to enhance their business, right? So it matters because whether you're a company or an individual, if you have a judgment that gets entered against you, there are a lot of adverse consequences that can flow from that. And so I want to talk about that today. But if you're also an individual or a business and you're owed money, right, not having money that is owed to you can also have an adverse consequence on you. And so what I want to talk about is, and kind of looking at both perspectives, is why it's really important to be proactive. And I guess let's start with if, and I thought you, this was beautiful when you said, you know, open the mail, right? Because let's say you have a credit card debt and you're getting letters from your credit card company and you're just throwing them away. You're not looking at what the debt is. You're just saying, you know what, I'm going to stick my head in the sand and hopefully nothing ever happens with this. Well, the reason why you don't want to do that and why you don't want to take any letter that purports to indicate that you are owing a debt to that individual or that company is because there's a legal cause of action called account stated. And what this says is that basically if you've had transactions with an entity and they send you a letter saying we've entered into whatever the obligation was and we've provided the service and you owe us X amount of dollars and you don't respond and indicate as to why that debt is disputed, that could be used against you in future litigation as a claim of we sent you a letter, you didn't dispute it, therefore we're going to claim that you owe it, among other reasons, when you may have a basis to defend against the debt that's being asserted against you. So start with opening the mail. Even if it's not a lawsuit, look at what is being asserted against you and put it in back in writing that you're disputing the debt. Start creating that record for yourself to protect yourself in the event of litigation. Now, on the flip side of this, if you're the company and you're trying to collect because you've got payroll you've got to make, you've got operational expenses that, and overhead that you've got to run, and we know trucking companies have a great deal of overhead, owner-operators have a great deal of overhead, the same thing. Be proactive in your collections. Send those demand letters out and have a confirmation or receipt that you sent those demand letters out or payment, so that when you're on the other side of the coin and you're pursuing a collection matter, you can do the same thing. You can indicate, I sent the demand letter out, there was no response, and therefore by their lack of response, they can take the position that it was accepted. And this is kind of a general principle here, but the main tagline is, like you said, they open your mail and respond and be proactive.
If you do get a judgment against you and you do open the mail and you do reply in writing to contest it, is it also on that end of the stick to have it certified or have some sort of tracking for that mail so that you can prove that you did respond, or is it not? Is that not necessary on that side?
So that's an excellent question, Dave. And so in the scenario that I was talking about was just when you had a letter. However, the situation changes dramatically when you've been served with a lawsuit. Mm. And if you've got notification that either you've been served with a summons and a complaint, or even if you've been served with a subpoena as a witness to an action, you need to get qualified counsel, and you need to respond to whatever, either the summons and the complaint or the subpoena. And let's start with the summons and the complaint. So if you've been served with process, and by the way, for our motor carriers out there, Dave, as you know, they're required to have what's called that BOC3 filing, mm-hmm. where they've designated a blanket registered agent to accept service on their behalf in any of the states. And so that service of process may come to them in the mail. It may not come in the form of a process server knocking on their door and serving an officer of the company. So you have to be very vigilant to ensure that you're getting notification of these filings through the mail, because that's how they may come. And now it may come differently depending on the situation that you've set up with your BOC3 agent. But in any regards, how you get that service of process, you want to make sure you get with your qualified counsel in understanding how you're going to respond to that. Because if you don't respond to a summons and complaint, and there's a and there is going to be indicated on the summons you have X amount of days, and it's going to vary depending on jurisdiction. That's why I say you get with your qualified counsel to understand what the time limitations are to respond. Because if you fail to respond, what the collections attorney or what the plaintiff's attorney is going to do is pursue a default against you, or if you're a company, against the company, and saying by failure to respond or file any paper in this action, they therefore admitted to the allegations in the complaint, and they're going to seek a default and ultimately a default final judgment. And then once that happens and that judgment's been entered against you, either as an individual, if you've been sued individually, or you as a company, if it's a company, then what's going to happen is the entity that has that judgment is going to then take steps to enforce the judgment. And that's where it can get very, very uncomfortable to have that judgment. And to your question, at that point, once you've had that judgment against you, if you've not taken any steps at that point, again, get with your qualified counsel, because there may be an opportunity for appeal, and there's very time-sensitive deadlines associated with an appeal. There may be opportunities to what's called vacate the judgment, and there's specific rules associated with that. Or there may be situations where you have to now comply with what's called post-judgment discovery, where the attorney is going to want to depose, that is, take your deposition or take the deposition of the officer with the most knowledge of the assets of the company and find out, where do you bank? Who are your clients? How much in receivables do you have owing? What assets do you have? How are those assets encumbered? And this go down the line. And once they have that information, then take that information and use to enforce the judgment to satisfy the amount that's owed. So when you get that judgment, it's not like you can't just write a letter and say, that's it, we don't have the money, right? And sometimes people just think, well, they're just going to have to collect and chase me down for it. And that's going to get into a whole host of other issues, because what can happen, for example, in Florida, is whenever I seek a judgment, I ask the defendant to present me what's called a fact information sheet, and it's actually attached to the judgment, meaning that the court has the authority to enforce the defendant to actually complete that fact information sheet. And so it's a way to understand what assets are available in the event that that judgment is something that we can collect on. And if the defendant fails to respond to that fact information sheet, you can pursue a motion for contempt, because that fact information sheet has the authority of the court behind it, meaning that the court can say to the defendant, I order you to respond to this fact information sheet. You didn't respond to the fact information sheet. I'm going to set a hearing for you to show cause as to why you shouldn't be held in contempt of court for not following that fact information sheet, and therefore then setting that matter for hearing, calling up the defendant or their counsel and saying, explain to us why you haven't responded to that. So there's certainly, you know, it's kind of a silence of the severity of what can happen when you don't pay attention and take the time to address these very serious notifications that come to you, whether it's by form of a service process or by in the mail or any other means that you've been notified of either demands for payment or litigation.
And it all starts with a letter that you could have responded to and maybe forestalled all of this stuff, but nothing ever goes away. I think that may be the takeaway here, right?
It is, and there is, I think, a misperception oftentimes that I see in the industry that people think, well, I don't have the means to pay, therefore they're not going to take action. Or there are situations where there may be a commonality between the notice that gets sent to one company and then a judgment that gets entered, and then that judgment, and I'm going to kind of explain this in a little bit more detail, then gets sought against what's called a successor entity. So even if you think as a company you may be safe because you're not associated with a former company that has all this bad debt, you have to be careful to make sure that somehow that judgment, that liability, can't flow to you.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Boy, that sounds pretty unjust, though, doesn't it? How does that reconcile with justice in terms
of... And that's the concern, right? And that's why I want to try to educate when it comes to the enforcement of judgments, because you could be, let's say that, Dave, we decided to open a company, and the company didn't do so well, and we had a number of debts that got accumulated against the company. And so we said, you know what, it's going to be in our best interest to go ahead and wind down that company, and let's just start a new company, and we'll be the owners of that new company, and we're going to continue to do the same thing that we did with the earlier company. And so the courts in that case say that there can be liability that flows to a successor company, and that's going to depend on a couple of situations. It's going to depend on, did us as the successor assume the obligations of the predecessor company? Did we have a merger or de facto, what's called a de facto merger? Did we merge with the predecessor company? Are we a mere continuation of the successor entity, of the predecessor? Or did we undertake this new entity to avoid a judgment and avoid liabilities? And so under those factors, the courts will go through an analysis and they'll say, all right, what was the basis for opening up this new entity? And where we have the same ownership in the situation where it's still you and I owning that same company and we're performing the same services that we previously performed, and perhaps we're even in the same building, or we have the same phone number, we have the same fax number, we have maybe a similar website. All of that commonality can be strung together for a party to indicate, well, look, you just opened up this new entity to avoid the liability. And so there may be what's called successor liability that can flow then to the new entity. So if you're reorganizing or you're in a situation where you have a lot of liabilities and you think, well, I can just avoid those liabilities by closing up my former corporation or maybe even just keeping it open and setting up a new company, that in and of itself, that new entity, that new corporate filing in and of itself will not protect you. There are ways that lawyers can get to that successor entity. And so that's how that's, in a very broad strokes explanation, just a little bit of a flavor for how successor entities can be held liable for companies that preexisted them.
Yeah, I understand the explanation. I think I must have misunderstood what the successor company was a little bit earlier. Let me ask you something. This is probably going to go way off into the weeds, Bridget, but... when you explained the successor company and what that means, The first thing that popped into my head is something else that comes up fairly often in trucking, and that is the so-called chameleon company, where somebody gets put out of service, and then the next thing you know, they just slap a new name on the side of the truck or the bus, and there they are in business again. Does this, what you just described in terms of a company shutting down, having owed people money, and now you have to tangle through, navigate through to find the successor company. Is there a combination of problems in terms of having companies that have the situation you just described, and then adding in the fact that, oh, yes, they're also a chameleon company? In other words, does the idea of a chameleon company, I'm really complicating this, I'm so sorry. Are they joined a lot more often than you might think? I guess that may be a way to ask that question.
Yeah, no, and what you bring up is a great point. And so kind of generally what I was talking about in the successor liability realm is liability for civil judgments that get entered against companies. Mm-hmm. But there's a separate line of authority as it relates to the FMCSA and their enforcement of, like you indicated, the chameleon carrier. And so in that line of authority, the FMCSA will look to a successor entity. Maybe it's a company that has the same ownership, or maybe they don't have the same ownership, but maybe they have the same managers or the same drivers or the same equipment. Maybe they're using the same infrastructure. Maybe even the contracts that they've had with their vendors are now in place with the successor entity. Perhaps they have the same insurance that the predecessor company has. And so what the FMCSA has developed is is that there is the ability for the FMCSA to issue what's called an out-of-service and record consolidation order, meaning that what the FMCSA will do if there is a company that by all appearances looks like a former company that had, let's say, numerous safety violations. They were over threshold on their basic categories. They had penalties that were assessed from the FMCSA that they hadn't paid. They were above the national average on the out-of-service orders, for example. And that from what the FMCSA can gather is that by all appearances, this new motor carrier company just closed its doors and opened up a new entity in order to avoid all the safety enforcement that the FMCSA had against the predecessor entity. And so the FMCSA can say, all right, you've created this new entity for an improper purpose. Maybe it was to avoid complying with the FMCSA order or a statutory requirement, like I said, civil penalty. So there's a number of factors then that the FMCSA can consider as to whether a motor carrier is a reincarnation or an affiliation of a prior entity. So I think you bring up, as always, Dave, an excellent point, because not only may you face issues in terms of civil liability from vendors that may be looking to collect payment, but you could also be facing a FMCSA enforcement action. So just hiding under a new corporate filing or a new FEIN number is not, at the end of the day, going to protect you, right? You've got to seek qualified counsel if you've got these severe issues to understand how you are going to either address them or effectively wind down your business. Because what's going to happen is not only may you as a company be facing this continuation of liability, but also there could be liability asserted against the ownership, the individual.
Wow, wow. Okay, we're going to take a quick break for news and weather. We'll be back on the other side. The phones are open. Bridget Blitch is with us. It's Protecting Your Livelihood.
Now, back to the Dave Nemo Show on SiriusXM's Road Dog Trucking Radio.
Coming up in just about an hour from now, it's Canada Calling with OBAC, the Owner-Operator Business Association of Canada. Joanne Ritchie, Executive Director, and Jim Park, Technical and Regulatory Advisor, join us for this week's edition of Canada Calling with the Owner-Operator Business Association of Canada. Right now, though, we are smack dab literally in the middle of our talk with Bridget Blitch. But I do want to remind you that the phones are open. If you have any questions or any concerns, 615-292-6366. And Bridget, I guess I was really, in a sense, mixing apples with oranges there when I took us off track. So I'll ask you to kind of gently move us back on course here this morning.
Oh, Dave, no, that's great. You can always take me off track, and because the issues that you bring up, I think, are critical to the industry. And so we were talking about now some of the other collateral consequences of that successor liability. And one of the things we left just before the break was whether or not the individual can be pulled in on behalf of an enforcement of a judgment. And that's, you know, a separate issue that we can consider. But one of the things that I wanted to focus on as well as these collateral consequences is that if you're in a situation where you've entered into a contract with an individual, that there may be there an opportunity for prevailing party attorney's fees. And that can go both ways. So let me just say this, that the general American rule is that everybody pays their own way when it comes to hiring an attorney. But you can enter into a contract with a vendor or with another entity or with an individual that says in the event of a dispute, the prevailing party will be awarded their reasonable attorney's fees and costs. And in that situation, what you've just set up then is that if you do proceed to litigation, or if you have a judgment entered against you, that attorney's fees can be awarded as part of that judgment. So if you're on the collecting end, that's a good thing because you're helping offset your overhead costs by not having to come out of pocket or at least get reimbursed for your attorney's fees. But if you're on the receiving end of the judgment, that's obviously a really unpleasant thing. Yeah. Nobody wants to pay for attorneys, let alone somebody else's attorney, right?
Yeah.
So it is important, you know, to always read your contracts. And I remember my contracts professor back in law school saying, you know, you've got a duty to read, right? It's not a defense not to read the contract. And how many times, you know, in a day, can you imagine, do people just scroll through contracts and click I accept, not knowing what is in the content of that contract? And so a prevailing party attorney fee provision could be right there in that contract, subjecting you to a prevailing party attorney fees in the event of a judgment. You could also be subject to interest. So that's another unpleasant consequence of a judgment, is particularly if you've got a judgment that's been outstanding and it's just been clocking along, accumulating all this interest. So now not only if you've received a judgment could you be responsible for paying the principal amount owed, but any interest that is pre-judgment as well as post-judgment interest.
Whoa. How would that interest be? What guide would they use to assess interest?
Well, it could be based on something that the parties contract around. So they could contract with, let's say, an 18% per annum interest rate, which would be the contractual pre-judgment interest rate. Or they could say 18% per annum pre- and post-judgment. Or in the absence of any specific statute or any contractual right to interest, there may be statutory pre-judgment or post-judgment interest that could come into effect. And so if there's interest that's been set by a particular state, so in the enforcement of that judgment, then what I will do, for example, is I'll ask the court to enter the statutory rate, a judgment that will accrue until the judgment is satisfied.
Mm.
So you have to be on guard for, you know, basically who call mitigating your damages, taking action to understand the effect of that judgment. And if it's something that you cannot satisfy, then consult with qualified bankruptcy counsel to explore your options as to whether that judgment is something that could be dischargeable, right? So, and then there's, you know, time-sensitive issues associated with that. Now, the other piece to this that maybe isn't always considered in talking about those long contracts that you click through on the internet, right, is that a lot of them have arbitration clauses. And so if there is a mandatory arbitration provision, what's often found in those types of clauses is that the parties will agree to be bound by an award of an arbitrator. And if the contract gives the, let's say, the arbitration association, and there's many of them out there, subject matter jurisdiction to review a dispute and enter an award related to that dispute, that's going to be as good as a judgment, right? I mean, with some exceptions, right? There's always exceptions to the rule, but that you can take that arbitration award and then you can have a court enforce that arbitration award. So now, basically, you're going to be in the same position you were as if a judgment had been entered against you. And those tools that could be used to enforce that judgment, only the party didn't have to go to court to get it. They just filed the claim with the arbitration association. And if you don't respond to the arbitration proceedings and you have that award get entered against you, you're in the same boat, one that we don't want to be in.
You are an arbitrator yourself for the American Arbitration Association. So this is something that you've been intimately involved with many times, I would imagine.
Yes, yes. And so a lot of parties opt for arbitration. They put it in their contracts because they want either an arbitrator with specialized knowledge, which is one of the unique aspects. I'm able to serve the community with my background in transportation law. But there's also the streamlined procedures. Depending on the amount in controversy, different rules can apply to help expedite the resolution of a case. So it can be something that's favored by parties, and then other times parties choose to go to court. Maybe they want a federal forum if it's available to them, or they want to just go through the litigation process to have a jury. So there's a lot of different avenues when you're on the collection side as to how tactically you want to pursue your judgment. So certainly I've had experience with as being an arbitrator. And it's something to be aware of is for our listeners is that it's not just serve as a process by process server in litigation, but it can also affect you if you've been served with process for arbitration proceedings.
One of the things that is part and parcel of trucking, as we all know, is that, yes, we have intrastate trucking, which has come up quite a bit in terms of the 18-year-old drivers now. That's one of the big topics of discussion in trucking. So you have interstate trucking. So therefore, if a lot of times you're going to be out of state, you're going to be in state, how does that play into, how does your location within the jurisdictional borders of a court play into all of this? I would imagine it adds yet another layer of complication that you just don't want to get into.
Well, that's another great question, Dave, is If you are contracting with a party, one of the things you want to put in your contract is a venue selection clause and a choice of law clause.
Okay.
And so that way, right, we want the law and the dispute to be as predictable as possible. So we understand, right, we want, I mean, ultimately, let me take this a step back. When we're working with other businesses, our goal is to have a great business relationship. And God forbid something happens where we get into a dispute, we want to know, what is the process that we're going to follow? Are we going to work in good faith to try to resolve that dispute? Absolutely we are. But if after all of our attempts at negotiation have failed and we have no other choice but to resort to either court or arbitration, we want to know, where is that court proceeding going to be held? And that's called the venue provision. So you want to say, and it may be dependent upon where's your principal place of business, or if you're an individual, where's your residence? Or if you have a terminal locations in a particular state and you want that state to be your venue provision, you consult with your qualified counsel to understand what are the benefits of choosing that particular forum or that particular state, as well as whatever choice of law that you would like to apply to that dispute. So you understand in the event of a dispute, okay, we're going to have some guidelines here. We're going to know that we're going to file a suit in this particular state, and this particular state law is going to apply. So to the extent that you can control that when you're contracting, whether you're contracting with a shipper or shippers, whether you're contracting with motor carriers or owner-operators contracting with motor carriers, right, in any arm's-length business relationship, you should have that contract that you've negotiated with your counsel, and you've identified that among many other provisions in your contract, but knowing where you're going to sue or unfortunately be sued.
Let me ask you a quick question, because we got a couple of callers here, and I know you want to talk to our listeners. How many times in your practice then has someone come to you and you become their attorney in a litigation, in a payment problem or whatever, judgments. How many times have you said, what does your location clause say? And they don't even know what you're talking about. In other words, is this something that folks, it's there and they don't even know it's there, and then the next thing you know, they find out the hard way? Is that pretty common?
Well, Dave, unfortunately, in the nature of this business, there are so many contracts that get pushed in and around offices where people just sign the contracts and they don't realize the significance of what is in those contracts. And so I'm forever on my soapbox saying, please send me your contracts so we can understand what your liability exposure is, and yes, where you're going to be sued. And certainly, folks, that is something that comes up that maybe they know, or maybe they haven't paid attention to it. But then if they have general counsel and they prefer to use their general counsel, well, now they're forced to hire an out-of-state attorney because they have a venue selection clause in Missouri or Kansas or wherever it happens to be.
Yeah, gotcha. Well, I'll tell you what, we're not going to go to Kansas, but we are going to Pennsylvania. And Steve is up in Pennsylvania with us. And Steve, good morning. You're up. We just lost Bridget. Steve, hold what you got. Don't go away. We're going to get Bridget right back here. Dre, let's take a quick break right here, and let's be right back.
There is a time when we should heed a certain cause, 'cause the world, it seems, it's right in this line, 'cause there's a chance for taking.
This is Tim Ashoff, president of Creek Carrier. Drivers are some of the hardest working people in the country, and that's why we believe you deserve more. Creek Carrier and Schaefer Trucking over-the-road drivers start out earning 49 to 55 cents per practical mile, and the top 50% of our drivers average over $75,000 per year. We are also proud to be an industry leader in benefits and safety. If you deserve more out of your career, visit creekcarrier.com.
We got Bridget back, and Steve, good morning again, and you're on with Bridget Blitch. Go right ahead.
Hi, Steve. Good morning.
Good morning. Hey, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I do have a question. I am based in Pennsylvania. I leased a trailer to a company, a trailer that I own to a company in Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
And through, I guess he defaulted. It was a lease-to-own setup. And he defaulted on the payments. I had to go repossess the equipment. So I have the equipment back in my possession. I have the judgment, because he didn't communicate, is in my favor. So I have that in writing. But now I don't know how to collect anything, or, like, what do I do about any of this?
Okay, Steve, that is a great question. And so one of the things that I look at when I've been handed a judgment and the client wants to execute on that judgment is, let's say you have received checks in the form of just for payments for the use of that trailer. And assuming I have a judgment, judgment's been recorded, file a writ of execution, and then I look at the check and I see, where has that person banked? And let's say if it's a local bank, a bank that's within the jurisdiction of where the judgment has been enforced, I will file a writ, a garnishment, and I will basically bring that bank into the proceedings, and I will ask the bank, all right, what money do you have of this individual to satisfy the judgment? So if that individual still banks at that location and the bank doesn't otherwise object to the garnishment proceedings, I may be able to just go ahead and take those assets or those monies that are in the bank account to satisfy the judgment. So that can be one of the most efficient ways, is I would look back at your payment history and see what checks do you have from this individual to indicate where they're banking, right? Because we want to understand what assets does this individual have in order to collect. And if we don't have a local bank, then we may need to go and domesticate a judgment, but domesticate the judgment in the location where the defendant has their assets. So in that way, the court in that jurisdiction can take a number of different steps in order to enforce that judgment. And that may be executing a levy to take equipment. It may be issuing a writ of garnishment if that person has contracted with another motor carrier and they're receiving payments, consideration from that other motor carrier. We can garnish that consideration. There may be other property that's available that we can basically take process on to try to satisfy the judgment. So I usually try to go the path of least resistance to get it satisfied as quickly as possible by looking of what information do we already have on record that we know that an individual defendant or corporate defendant has to try to satisfy that judgment. And then if we have to go outside of whatever information we have, then we may need to domesticate that judgment, engage in what's called the post-judgment discovery. So that's you have the right to take this individual's deposition, issue what's called written interrogatories or what's called written request for production to ask for information to enforce that judgment. So depending on the local procedure at issue, there may be different avenues to enforce that judgment for you.
Steve, thank you very much for the call. That was a great question, Bridget. And let's go for one more phone call. I think we can make it out to Utah. And Luke is with us on the line. Hey, Luke, you're on with Bridget Blitch. Go right ahead.
Good morning, Luke.
Yeah, hello. I just had a quick question about juries. Do we have a right to a jury of our peers trial? I mean, anytime somebody takes us to court?
Well, and that's going to depend on what kind of cause of action and what forum you've been sued in. Certainly, that's one of the first issues that I will always look at when I'm representing a defendant and there hasn't been a request for a jury trial. That's one of the very first issues when you're responding to a complaint, that you make sure that when you work with your qualified counsel that you inform them, you know, I want a jury trial. Explain to me if you have any concerns as to why you don't think a jury would benefit me in this forum, and I want you to preserve my right in the initial filing of an answer to my right to a jury trial. So your local rules in the different various jurisdictions are going to influence that, and depending on what kind of, again, proceedings, whether it's civil or criminal, that you have. Certainly that's a very important issue and one you always want to bring up with your counsel. And to that end, let me just say this. Whether you're an individual or a corporation, you want to get with your qualified counsel, because oftentimes if you're running a company, even if it's just you individually, companies cannot represent themselves pro se. There are very limited circumstances. Like in small claims court in Florida, for example, a company can represent themselves pro se, but don't assume that just by filing an answer individually or asserting a right to a jury trial individually that that's protected that right.
Okay, thanks.
Yes, you bet.
Thank you very much, Luke. Bridget, thank you so much for being with us here this morning and walking through those weeds with us here. And we're looking forward to catching up with you in Dallas later on this month at GATS.
All right, Dave. Sounds terrific. I look forward to it as well. Thank you so much, as always, for allowing me to share this valuable information.
Bridget Blitch, everyone, with Blitch Wesley Attorneys at Law. To get in touch, the phone number is 407-574-2835. 407-574-2835. Online, it's blitchwesley.com, and that's spelled BLITCHWESTLEY, blitchwesley.com. It's about 2 minutes now till the top of the hour.
Flow, I like nitro, cool as ice though, that type of dichotomy, y'all know it's gotta be.
As we all know, when you're on the road, safety is everything. That's why Help Incorporated, proud provider of pre-pass, waystation bypass, and e-tolling, has invested $700 million into making roads safer nationwide. With pre-pass, you avoid congestion around waystations and reduce the need to merge in and out of highway traffic. And transponders are hands-free to help you stay focused. Keep our highways safe and bypass with PrePass today. They're offering 1 month of free service to try before you buy. So call them, 888-599-PASS, and use promo code NEMO, or visit prepass.com/NEMO, 888-599-7277, or visit prepass.com/NEMO.
I'm a modern day cowboy. I ride 18 wheels. My bed rolls up behind my
Dave Nemo. with you. We are proud to be part of Truckin' Life. Thanks again to Bridget Blitch for joining us on the program. Thanks to you for joining us. And I hope you'll stay with us. Coming up at the bottom of the next hour, Canada Calling with OBAC.